what an astonishing thing a book is. It's a flat object made from a tree with flexible parts on which are imprinted lots of funny dark squiggles. But one glance at it, and you're inside the mind of another person. Maybe somebody dead for thousands of years. Across the millennia, an author is speaking clearly and silently inside your head, directly to you. Writing is perhaps the greatest of human inventions, binding together people who never knew each other, citizens of distant epochs. Books break the shackles of time. A book is proof that humans are capable of working magic.
I'll never forget the first time I saw Carl Sagan utter those words on the original Cosmos episode entitled Persistence of Memory, and it seems appropriately surreal that it's also the title of a famous painting by Salvador Dali. Because Cosmos wasn't just a TV series, it was also a work of art and powerful in its literate and deeply philosophical examination of our place in space and time. His take on how amazing books are make for the most appropriate entrance to this show, because a very special book is the subject of this episode of Blue Dot, and welcome, as always, to a look at our place in space. Sasha Sagan's new book, For Small Creatures Such as We, Rituals for Finding Meaning in Our Unlikely World, is one of many books that are sent to me by book publishers, and most of them are wonderful and you hear about their authors on this program. But this one was truly special to me. The very existence of this show owes much to Carl Sagan and his wife, Anne Druyan, his partner in creating the Cosmos TV series, and some of my favorite books, like Shadows of Forgotten Ancestors and Comet. So when I got a copy of Sasha Sagan's new book in my hands, I was both excited and anxious. Would it live up to my expectations? I'm happy to say it exceeded them, and I knew it would when I read the first epigraphs, the quotes at the beginning of each chapter that invoke the theme of what's to come, that her mother and father used to use so effectively in their books. So before we begin our visit with Sasha, I will share the first two from Sasha's introduction. I am a deeply religious non-believer. This is a somewhat new kind of religion. Albert Einstein. A life without festivity is a long road without an inn. Democritus of Abdera. Sasha Sagan, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, before we go any further, I want you to know that I thoroughly enjoyed this book.
Thank you.
And have bought it for my children as holiday presents. So surprise kids.
Oh, and, wonderful. Spoiler alert.
Yeah, so they know. One of them even asked and said, you know, if you're not going to get me that book, you know, I'll just go to the bookstore. And said, no, I already got it for you.
Oh, that's so lovely.
One other thing I wanted to pass along. I always tell people that your father, Carl Sagan, he's the patron saint of Blue Dot. And always when I say that, it makes me laugh inside because it's like he was not our patron and he's not a saint, but it works for me.
Totally. I know what you mean. It's sort of the secular version of it. It's like, I don't know if you've seen this, but my younger brother sent me recently, you know, like the candles that you sometimes see actual, you know, decorated with actual Catholic saints. Well, they've made a whole line of sort of secular scientific ones, and my brother sent me one with our dad on it, and I think that's sort of in the same theme of the secular patron saint.
That's perfect. I will be sure before I forget to light a candle for your dad on December 20th.
Thank you so much. Thank you. That's really lovely.
So let's go back to the title. Where does the title come from? As if I don't know.
Yes. Well, so Contact is the only work of fiction that my dad ever published. It's the only novel he wrote. He wrote so many nonfiction books and essays, many of them together with my mom, Anne Druyan, who I know has also been on your show. And but Contact was the only novel, and they started out, they wanted it to be a movie, but movies take very long time to make this one in particular. And during the time that my parents were working on trying to get it made, they wrote it as a novel together. And one of the lines in the novel is, "For small creatures such as we, the vastness is bearable only through love." And that sort of was like a kind of like a family mantra in a way, and sort of a way for us who, you know, my father was a scientist, my mother is a science communicator, and they raised me with the idea that science was the pathway to understanding and to answering those deep, difficult, profound questions that sort of haunt all of us in different ways. But this sort of scientific worldview, while skeptical, was not cynical. And that idea that love, that the idea that here we are on this pale blue dot in the middle of endless vastness, but we have each other, and that can be a source of real meaning and reassurance and beauty, and that's what we should sort of celebrate, really is... became the very first seedling of what eventually became my book.
And that kind of answers my next question. And by the way, Contact is a dear novel for my family. My daughter, her hero is Ellie Arroway, and I'm sure she's a scientist too now. And for, you know, so many women scientists her generation, you know, Ellie was a real hero to them.
Absolutely. Oh, that's so lovely to hear.
And so when did you decide, you know, to actually to embark on writing this book?
Oh, well, it's a good question. You know, in some funny way, when people are like, "When did you start writing this book?" I want to be like, you know, the day I was born, which is a little extreme, but it does feel like it's so much of it is the philosophy and worldview that my parents instilled in me from a very young age. And but in terms of actually sitting down and writing it, it sort of started around the time that my husband and I started thinking about having a family. And then all those philosophical questions that we each have, but we can always sort of put into the back of our minds, all of a sudden comes into stark relief when you start thinking about, well, I'm going to have a little person who's going to be asking some of these questions and asking why we do things the way we do them and what we celebrate and what, you know, what we believe. And all of a sudden I started thinking about, you know, there's so many people who are secular or who see themselves as spiritual but not religious, or even maybe who are religious but have some nagging doubt in one way or another. And we all have to navigate, you know, all these changes that happen over the course of life on Earth, all these entrances and exits. And I really think that so many of our rituals around the world throughout time are about how to process these changes. My mother always says, there's no refuge from change in the cosmos. And it's true. And, you know, every celebration, every coming of age ritual, every funeral, every wedding, every baby naming, or, you know, other million different incarnations of celebrations and rites of passage when babies are born. You know, these are all really about these changes that we all have to come to terms with. So I started thinking about, well, how are we going to navigate this kind of thing? And I thought maybe other people might be interested in some of those questions too.
And through the structure of your book, you go through kind of the course of a year and these life events like birth and death and independence and weddings and things like that, that give our lives this structure that it has, as such as it is, and the importance that you say that these rituals and these ways we have of interacting with each other and creating your own rituals, which you've done, I really found that to be, you know, quite useful. As I read it, I thought, you know, this is something that, you know, really I think everybody could get something from.
Thank Thank you. Well, what's so amazing and what I couldn't sort of, I just was left so astonished as I continued reading and researching, you know, when you sort of peel back the specifics of time and place and culture and tradition, we really are all celebrating the same things. And some are biological, like, you know, coming of age and birth and death. And some of them are just, you know, just astronomical, you know, the changing of the seasons, the axial tilt, the solstices and equinoxes, the phases of the moon, which are so central to the timing of so many celebrations around the world. These are real, tangible, scientific things that sort of, when it's, they get sort of disguised as being very, you know, religious or mythological or theological. But I think that there's a through line here really around the world. And what I found so wonderful was that it was so scientific, even though so many of the celebrations and rituals predate our understanding of why, you know, the length of days was changing or, you know, whatever the specific thing was. But it really comes from something that now we can understand on another level, which is really beautiful to me.
And me too. And I'd like to, let's talk about some of my favorite moments in your book, so you could give me some more insight. Of course, at its core, you know, it seems to me this really is a love letter to your parents. And I think you even say that at some point. And it's just, it comes across that way, that this is a way of you honoring your mother and father.
Yes, that's really what I was hoping. Thank you, because that's really what I was hoping to communicate with it. And it's a way of celebrating what they taught me and so much of, you know, I think what they're so gifted at, what my father was so gifted at, what my mother was so gifted at, is finding a way to explain things that can be very complicated and sort of, you know, facts get sort of described as like cold and hard, and finding this meaning and beauty in it and making it very understandable to people. And that's something I really wanted to celebrate.
And one of my favorite scenes is it starts out with you and your father, I believe at the Natural History Museum there in New York, and you looking at the dioramas and thinking that they're moving. Could you just share that memory with us a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, we used to go, I grew up in Ithaca in upstate New York, but we would go down to the city quite often, and my dad would take me to see the dioramas. And, you know, when you're little and it's like, you see, you know, it's like lions and gazelles and bears and these giant animals, and it's so easy to let, you know, your little eyes play tricks on you. And I would be so convinced that they were moving. And it was, you know, in a way it was really funny, but it was also a sort of an entryway into talking about some really difficult things. And like the idea of saying, well, they're not moving because they're dead. And the idea of death and how we describe that to children and what we talk about, especially if we're secular and we don't think that there's evidence of anything afterwards. And that's sort of how, I don't know, it's also, I think it was also really important to me because it was the idea that sometimes we think we see things and we think, you know, our eyes play tricks on us, our minds play tricks on us, our emotions play tricks on us. And sometimes we have to take a step back and look at the evidence. And I just had to face facts and realize the lion was definitely not moving as I acquired more evidence on the subject. But that was, you know, that's sort of a ritual of ours when we would go down to New York. And it's also, it was, you know, for those of us who are not religious, museums, among other places, you know, I feel this way at the aquarium or at like a great library, you know, but these are these other kind of temples to understanding and knowledge and a deeper connection to our the other creatures on the planet and the other human beings. And I think there's something about being in a museum, even when you're very little, even if you're not quite old enough to read the detailed information under every exhibit, that gives you a sense of awe for knowledge.
Yeah. And I'd love the picture in my mind of you kind of standing right next to your father's leg you know, tugging on his hand, like, Dad, I think that moved.
Yeah, totally hiding behind like a khaki pant, being like, I can't, this is too scary. I can't handle it.
Let's take a short break. You are listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlom. Our guest is Sasha Sagan, author of the new book, For Small Creatures Such as We, Rituals for Finding Meaning in Our Unlikely World. Sasha is the daughter of the author and TV producer Anne Druyan and her late husband, the astronomer and science popularizer Carl Sagan. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's continue now with our visit with Sasha Sagan about her new book, For Small Creatures Such as We, Rituals for Finding Meaning in Our Unlikely World. Sasha is the daughter of the late astronomer and science popularizer Carl Sagan and author and TV producer Anne Druyan. Druyan's reboot of the Cosmos program she did with her late husband, Cosmos, A Space-Time Odyssey with Neil deGrasse Tyson, will air its second season in the spring of 2020 on Fox and National Geographic. And spoiler alert, Sasha plays her grandma in it. One of the parts of the book I found deeply meaningful but difficult is the loss of your father and how emotionally difficult that is for everyone who loses a parent. But you communicate how difficult it's been for you and how it's been a part of your life. And I thought you weave that through the story so well. I'd like to go to your wedding, because that's one of the things that I know you found particularly difficult, because in our culture, you know, you have the father walking the daughter down the aisle and all that. For all of its misogynistic origins, it's still a tradition. And, you know, one thing I learned is you are a person who honors traditions in your family. So tell us about your lovely husband, John, and how you kind of got through that and where you had your wedding, because I thought that was really cool.
I was so lucky because, I mean, you know, a lot of people lose their parents before, or a parent before they get married. And, you know, each one of us has to sort of navigate that, like anything, for ourselves and figure out a way to honor the person that they've lost in a way that's meaningful to them. And, you know, we have so many different ways, and I've been to so many different weddings where there's different versions of, you know, a photograph of them or, you know, something that belonged to them. And we did some things like that too, but I just had this incredible good fortune. Around the time we got engaged, I thought to myself, I really want to get married in a place where my dad and I had been together. Not because I thought, you know, anything supernatural, like part, you know, his he would be there in spirit or anything like that, but because I would feel connected to him there. And it would be, you know, poetic, if nothing else. And as I mentioned, I'm from Ithaca in upstate New York, and there's a very lovely modern art museum there. And not long, or around the time we got engaged, John and I, the artist Leo Villarreal, who makes these amazing installations and uses LED lights to make these gorgeous, huge, often very science and space-themed installations, had put in this enormous piece called Cosmos, inspired by my dad's work, my parents' work. And it was this, so there's like a large balcony at the museum with a ceiling that juts out like three stories above it. And the bottom of the ceiling was like an ever-changing night sky. I mean, you can Google the pictures of it. If you Google Cosmos Johnson Art Museum, Ithaca, you can probably get there. But it's so beautiful and so stunning. And it was like, well, we it became very clear very quickly once we saw it, we have to get married here. And it was like this unbelievably poetic, perfect thing. And we danced the night away under this art installation, and it was so magical. And I mean, I know that that's like a really lucky random coincidence to have that, but it also sort of got me thinking about how much of our traditions and the ways that we honor those we've lost, and even just any tradition around getting married, it is kind of an art piece. And you know, we have these sort of, right, a wedding has this sort of performative quality where it's helping the couple but also the community transition, you know, from okay, these two people are single to they're making a commitment to be together for the rest of their lives. And we all sort of go through the portal together when we go to a wedding. And there are so many little customs and little things that when you sort of step outside of it, it's fascinating. I mean, just the idea of like, you know, you wear a metal circle on your third finger and then other people know, okay, you're not available. You know what I mean? If you were sort of looking at it from the outside or from, you know, if you were from a totally other culture or planet, you would be like, okay, well, that's really specific that they've chosen that as their custom. But there's so much stuff like that in weddings. And like you were saying, like the idea of like being given away, you know, is so old fashioned. But I really felt so sad that I didn't have my dad to walk me down the aisle and to do those other things that are so central to the ritual, you know, even if it comes from a place where, you know, women were sort of not considered fully animate human beings making their own decisions. But yeah, there was so much in that, but I couldn't believe how fortunate we were to have access to this beautiful museum with this beautiful exhibit that we could dance the night away under.
And by the way, your husband, John, comes across as just a really great guy. I love the part where you basically are throwing yourself at him when you're first courting.
Yes. Oh my goodness. Let me just say, he is amazing, and I just could not adore him more. He is so great, and he's very shy. And during this whole process of writing this book, I was like, "Are you sure it's okay for me to write about this?" And he was so encouraging. But yes, I go into great detail about me totally throwing myself at him. I could not have come on any stronger, and eventually he gave in to my advances. But yes, I mean, but again, it's like one of those things that when you take a step back, and kind of how I describe it in the book, it's really, you know, a mating ritual.
Yeah, well, you sound like a perfect couple, and I found that part of the book very enjoyable. We have something in common, among many things, that the secular Judaism, you know, family aspect for sure. My father came from a Jewish family, but he married a woman who came from a fundamentalist Christian background. So I grew up very confused. So I, you know, that's why I was so glad to find your mom and dad's books. Things started to make sense for me finally. But anyway, I grew up with a working mom and dad. And so I had a third parent who was a nanny, and her name was Molly. Name started with an M. Tell us about your nanny.
Oh, Maruja. So yes, exactly. She lived with us from the time I was 6 weeks old till I was 8. And then she came back to visit because we loved each other very much every summer for many years. Well, when I was well beyond the age of needing to be nannied. And she so my parents, secular Jews, as I mentioned, and as we share, Maruja was a devout Roman Catholic, and she had been a cloistered nun in the Andes Mountains, and she left the convent not because of a of any loss of faith. I'll save the story for people who want to read the book about how she left, but she left still with her religious convictions totally intact. And she lived with us, and she didn't drive. So my mom and I would take her to church every Sunday, and her priest, Father Tony, would sometimes come to dinner at our house. And my parents really, to their credit, like, there was no censorship at all. And I knew that what Maruja believed was totally different than what my parents believed. And that was fine. And sometimes Maruja would even take me to church with her, especially if we were traveling. And she was an amazing, wonderful person. And one of the moments that I describe in the book that I think really crystallized so much of sort of who I became and what this book is about is I was like kind of a little bit of a morbid child, I would say. And one day I went to my parents and I was like, you know, Maruja says that when you die, you go to heaven and you're with God. And you guys say that when you die, it's like you're asleep forever without dreaming. Who's right? And my parents, in unison, so joyfully, without hardly even thinking about it, said, both of them said, nobody knows. Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. I love that.
Thank you. And I just thought, you know, especially because my, you know, the idea of admitting to a child that there are things we don't know, there are things, you know, obviously there are things each of us don't know, but there are things that none of us know. There are things we'll all find out in time. There are things that, you know, our species may find out when we're all long gone. And just the idea that sometimes we have to sort of leave a question open if we don't have the answer, rather, you know, and as my parents would say, tolerate the ambiguity rather than sort of fill something in because it's so uncomfortable, which it often is, to just not know.
Yes, and it seems to me, and I believe I read this somewhere in your book, that your parents taught you to be secular but not cynical.
Exactly.
And accepting and curious about other people's beliefs, like Maruja's. And one of the things I really enjoyed about your book, which reminded me so much of your father's writing and his educational background, is you delve into so many different cultures and their ways of looking at rituals and things in life. So I'd like to take a look at Halloween briefly, if we could, because you had this horrible Halloween experience.
Oh, yes. Well, it's true. And it's so funny because what I really think is that so often, you know, of course, now people celebrate rituals all over the world and, you know, sometimes in the opposite hemisphere than where they were originated. But like the idea of all of these, you know, Samhain and, you know, All Souls Day and Dia de los Muertos, all of these sort of kind of dark, a little bit scary fall, you know, fall into early winter rituals that sort of are around, you know, the autumnal equinox. They all sort of share this idea of like we are facing our mortality and winter is coming and it's real. And for most of history, you know, we didn't know if everybody was going to survive, you know, if we'd have enough food, if we'd be able to withstand the cold. And I think there are so many of these rituals that at their heart is about facing our mortality. But at my otherwise lovely elementary school, there was a Halloween time ritual that really was overtly about facing mortality in a way that I, as like a 5-year-old, was not prepared for, which was, I mean, and it is really, I can see why they did this, and I see how it was really wonderful. Careful in one way, but I don't think we were sufficiently prepared to walk a couple of blocks to the assisted living facility and just like do a parade through the facility for many elderly people who were just like happy grandparents, but a large number of people who were really at the end of their lives in a way that was so scary at that age. And I think it would have been so much better if it was just explicitly said, like, these people are very, very old and they're not going to live much longer and we're going to go cheer them up, but this is going to be a little bit disturbing for you, oh, kindergartner. And but it was like this ironic thing where I was like, this, you know, at the time, I was like, this isn't what we're supposed to be doing for Halloween. We should be like, you know, going around the neighborhood getting candy. This isn't what Halloween is really about. But as I got older and I got sort of a clearer idea of some of the origins of all these autumnal rituals, I was like, you know, in retrospect, that really is what Halloween is about, is facing our fears. And what is a bigger fear than our own mortality?
Yeah, but when you're that little, that might be a bit much.
It was a little intense. I mean, yeah. My girlfriends and I still have all my best friends that I had at that age. And we've all said to each other, you know, decades later, like, that was really intense. That was so scary. Why did we do that?
Oh, well. Another part of the Halloween tradition that you tie into, which very much resonates with your father and did with me because I drive a sensible station wagon, is that you look at the traditions of cultures, looking at my absolute favorite group of stars in the sky.
Yes, the Pleiades. And they're so beautiful. And there's so many beautiful stories and mythologies around when they appear in the night sky. And I mean, everything from, I'm going to have to look in the book what I think it's the Mono people of California, of what's now California, I believe. I might have to double check that.
Yeah,
but
it
who
is.
Saw them. Oh, it is. Okay, good. Who saw them as women who preferred, a group of seven women who preferred onions to husbands, which is just the most charming thing ever. And then of course, Subaru, which is the Japanese word for which, you know, as you said, sensible station wagons and radio telescopes have been named. And I just think the idea that we all, you know, all these cultures that had no way of communicating with one another picked the same things, you know, in so many cases to find meaning in and beauty and to be inspired by, is so, so thrillingly wonderful to me.
And I especially love them because I didn't know about the Mono culture, because I am a big fan of that part of California and go to Mono Lake all the time. It's a beautiful place. And if you're ever in California, in Eastern California or Yosemite, go see it because it's spectacular.
Great to know. I love that's wonderful.
So it was like when I read that, I didn't know that. So I'll always think about the Mono women and the onions.
Yes.
There's lots of cool stories like that, and I don't want to give away too many of them because, you know, we want people to actually read the book.
Would be good. but either way, it's great.
There's a couple more I really enjoyed, and relating to your father especially, was the idea of March 4th. That one I thought was fantastic. You want to explain to us the meaning of March 4th?
Yes. So, you know, there are so many rituals about asking for forgiveness in different religions. And, you know, in Judaism, we have Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, which, you know, includes this idea of going around and apologizing to people that you've, you know, wronged in some way over the course of the year. And my mother and I always talk about how it's, in a way, it's like, so it's such a great, I mean, it's really great to be apologetic, but also it's very scientific in a way to sort of take stock and see, you know, where you can improve and what's not standing up to scrutiny and the ways that you can go forward. And so, of course, in English, March 4th is the only day of the year that works as this kind of pun command, you know, to like march forth and like, you know, proceed, be better, improve, go forward, evolve in the non-literal sense. You know, so we sort of always had this joke about March 4th as being, you know, a day you could sort of take stock and apologize and improve. And then I was looking at at Pale Blue Dot, at the book Pale Blue Dot, and there is like a footnote, tiny little footnote about how in 1953 BCE, in ancient China, there was a moment where for the first time the five visible planets were visible, and it completely changed their view of the cosmology of their world, and they completely changed their idea of their place in the universe. And it was on, coincidentally, March 4th. Of course, they had a totally different calendar. They didn't call it March 4th. It wasn't a pun, but it was like this wonderful little coincidence in a footnote that made me think this could really catch on, you know.
You're listening to Blue Dot, and thanks for doing that. After a short break, we'll continue our conversation with Sasha Sagan about her new book, For Small Creatures Such as We, Rituals for Finding Meaning in Our Unlikely World. It's a love letter to her parents, Carl Sagan and Ann Druyan, about the importance of family and friends in the context of the deep history of human culture. And we're back. Let's resume our conversation with Sasha Sagan, the daughter of Ann Druyan and Carl Sagan. Her new book, For Small Creatures Such as We, Rituals for Finding Meaning in Our Unlikely World, is both a love letter to her parents and also a look at how rituals, both simple and complex, help define our humanity.
So my mom had, you know, more than a few times mentioned this essay that my dad had written. It's about the idea that in science, you know, science has an error correcting mechanism, and you know, the idea is whatever doesn't stand up to scrutiny has to fall away. And, you know, that means sometimes you have to admit that you're wrong. And that he had written this essay about all these things that he had been wrong about, sort of being dismissive of The Simpsons without having really watched it was one example. Sort of he had gotten that it was like subversive, and then he had watched it and realized he had been wrong. And another thing was when right after my brother was born, he had gone on TV and made a prediction that the oil fires in Kuwait were going to have this instantaneous terrible impact on the on the atmosphere, which they didn't. And this a handful of things that like every person, especially every person, but especially every person who's in the public eye, you know, sometimes you say things publicly and you think later you get more information and you realize that you were mistaken. And my mom had described this essay so many times that I thought that I had read it, which was not true. So I really had believed that I had read it. And then I started thinking about it and Googling it while I was working on this chapter about sort of how we can, you know, be better at admitting when we're wrong. I realized that I couldn't find it. And I asked my mom to find it, who had been talking about it. And she realized she couldn't find it. And slowly she realized, wait a second, maybe it actually was never published. And that sort of, then I thought, okay, well, a lot of their papers are in the Library of Congress. And so maybe I could ask someone there to see if there's some draft of it or something like that. And no luck. We still don't know if it just, I think maybe it was just a conversation they had. And, you know, as time goes on and, you know, memories sort of crystallize and fade in different ways. But it was one of these things that I so wish existed. I so wish I could read. But I think that the crux of it is still so important. This idea of if we just became more comfortable, all of us, with saying, you know, I was really wrong about that. I understand that now. And if we sort of had put a little more value on the idea of improving and, you know, being able to say, I used to think this thing and that I was completely mistaken about, and now I understand better, I think we would all, not just in the scientific arena, but certainly in political and personal and countless other ways, really all benefit from taking away some of the stigma of the idea of, like, I was totally wrong about something.
Yeah, I think once people get entrenched in a position, it's just more comfortable for them to keep defending it, even though they know deep down that they're wrong. It's too hard for them to make that turn towards atonement, which is too bad, because it harms them more than anyone.
Yes, and the irony is that we're all guilty of it. Every single one of us is wrong, you know, frequently, and that's part of life. And if we sort of could see ourselves and each other that way, maybe it's just a matter of leading by example. The more people who do it, the more comfortable people will be with it. But it's a really tough thing.
Well, let's all do it on March 4th next year.
Yes, I love it.
And while your mom and dad are woven through the story a lot, and they're definitely part of the tapestry of your life, you have these really cool parts of your own life that I really enjoyed. I got a kick out of you and your women friends, and your dining out night, how that evolved into a bi-coastal thing.
Yes. So, you know, I mean, one of the things that I read about that I really think is hard about being secular and not having a religious community is, you know, you have to work to congregate. And I'm really, you know, gregarious, I guess you would say. And I really like being around people. And, you know, if I was very devout, I would have a setting to do that every week. And if I was very devout, I would have sort of like, you know, I might be more likely to have a sort of like women's community. And I have really fantastic girlfriends. I have my best girlfriends I grew up with. I have so many interesting, wonderful women I've met in adulthood. And after we lived abroad for a couple of years, we came back to New York, and I started thinking, I've got to see everybody all together at once instead of just seeing people one at a time, because there was so much to catch up on. And because I realized that all these people I knew would get along really well. And so I started planning this, like, a little bit silly, but really fun monthly dinner called the Ladies Dining Society. And it became this amazing thing where all these women really started their own friendships and their own relationships. And, you know, as people moved and had kids and, you know, their jobs or their lives took them to other parts of the country, this sort of spread. And I have these friends now who carry on this Ladies Dining Society ritual in different cities. And it just became this wonderful thing that now that I don't live in New York, you know, I don't do as much anymore. I sort of occasionally still try to, but it's not, certainly not a monthly thing. And I am a mom now, and you know how these sort of things fall away, but it lives on in other places. And it just struck me as something that, you know, rituals have this connotation of being sort of religious or cultural, but I think each of us have a collection of personal rituals that we do that we don't really think of so much as rituals. But if you have like happy hour on Thursdays with your coworkers every week, or you know, have movie night with your partner, or you have these things that are this way of creating a rhythm to your life and marking time and congregating, you know, even if it's a small group, even if it's two people every week or every month. I think we all crave that in different ways. And like this idea of there being something steady in a world where so much is unpredictable. And I think even if you're totally secular, there's a pathway to this kind of thing that doesn't, even though sort of historically the infrastructure has been religion, it doesn't have to be.
And it seems to me, reading your book, that you really, even though you are a secular person, you're also very deeply tied to your cultural roots and your family, to paraphrase, the shadows of your not forgotten ancestors.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, even the forgotten ones, because that's the thing, even though I don't subscribe to their theology or worldview, after a few generations back, I don't know the names of my ancestors. I don't necessarily know the villages that they came from. I just know that they were Jews. And that's sort of the only connection beyond three or four generations back where I can trace some little clues. And there is something, I think people, you know, we all crave this in a way. There is something about doing something that you're ancestors have been doing for centuries or millennia that makes you feel connected to your place in this chain. And, you know, whether it's lighting a candle or saying special words or going somewhere on the same day of the year, there is something about that that I think is really meaningful and touching. And I think there's a way you can honor your ancestors by taking the pieces of that that speak to you without being obliged to do the stuff that just doesn't match your modern worldview or philosophy. Because, you know, no matter how devout you are, whatever you're doing a few hundred years ago would be unrecognizable. You know, rituals and traditions and customs are constantly changing and morphing. And they have to in order to survive, because our society changes and every element of our traditions ends up reflecting that over time. But I think there's something about carrying on the pieces of it that are really meaningful to you that's valuable. And, you know, there are things that I do, like you mentioned about lighting a candle on December 20th. You know, there's a Jewish custom of lighting the Yahrzeit candle, which is a candle that burns for 24 hours, and you light it on the anniversary of someone's death. And, you know, that doesn't require theism, from my perspective, to be beautiful and meaningful and a little moment to reflect on the life of somebody that you loved and lost. And there are things like that. And, you know, people, so many holidays get celebrated in a, you know, a secular sense, and so many rituals sort of take on different meanings as time goes on. And I think we're all sort of, you know, interpreting the ways of our ancestors to match our, you know, more modern perspectives.
Well, one of the things that I found really resonated with what you just said, and something that I've been looking very forward to, is the next installment of Cosmos, a Space-Time Odyssey, which we're going to finally get to see in spring, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Because you're in it.
Yes, I am in it. I have a very, very small role with no lines, but I do have a little cameo where I play my grandmother in this scene where my dad is a little boy in his childhood apartment in Brooklyn, you know, and it was really, one of the other themes in my book is time travel and my sort of lifelong fascination with it. And wow, let me tell you, getting onto that soundstage and being in this set that was designed to look like the Bensonhurst apartment where my father grew up, and be all dressed up and made up to look like my grandmother, who I do look a lot like, and but never knew. And that really felt like this unbelievable experience of time travel and feeling connected to this ancestor who I got to play for a day. And it's an amazing thing to be able to experience and sort of meditate on that idea that, you know, this is someone who I didn't know, but I carry her DNA in my body and I'm connected to her. And, you know, that's one of so many things where the way that scientific, you know, fact gets presented sometimes obscures the beauty and just totally breathtaking, amazing ideas behind it that we just sort of, you know, when you're like in biology class and you're learning about like alleles, you're not getting this sense. I mean, maybe you are. Hopefully you are. Hopefully you have a really inspiring biology teacher. But you're usually not getting this sense of, wow, there is this secret code in your blood that connects you to your ancestors and back to the earliest humans and to other people on Earth who you just would never know that you were related to. And it's so much like something out of a fairy tale or out of a ancient mythology, but it's true and it's real. And I was really sort of feeling that day that we were filming this scene, and I was like, you know, I'll never know her, but I have some part of her with me always.
And I wonder what it was like for the boy that was acting, playing your father, for him, from his point of view.
Yeah. And I was like, I'm playing my grandmother. I mean, when I first met him, I was like so excited. I'm sure he was like, this woman is bonkers. He was like, you know, adolescent, young guy, and he was great. He was really good.
Oh, I know I'm going to cry when I see that part now. That's wonderful. Yeah, that's wonderful. And time travel. There was one of my favorite line in your book, or one of my many favorite lines, was your dad's take on time travel, that we are time travelers, one step at a time into the future.
Right, exactly. One second at a time, we're going forward. I'm like, that's not what I mean, Dad. But of course, accuracy zealot always, and in the most wonderful way. But it was just such a perfect example of like his take on these kind of things, where it's like, good news, we are time traveling. It's just in a very narrow way.
Yeah, no, I thought that was a great dad way of putting things.
Yeah.
I also want to just thank you so much for spending time with us today, because I know how busy you are. I hope you're not getting tired of talking about your book.
No, it's been so much fun, and I'm really enjoying it. I'm so glad I got to talk to you today.
Thanks to our guest, Sasha Sagan. Her new book, For Small Creatures Such as We, Rituals for Finding Meaning in Our Unlikely World, is available from all major booksellers. Of all the books that we have shared with our listeners over the years, I can't think of one that I can more highly recommend for you to give to friends and family this holiday season. While its core message is secular, it is also deeply respectful to all cultures and religions. And at this time, that's truly valuable. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. You can revisit this or past episodes you missed at mynspr.org, or better yet, subscribe to our podcast on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcast groove on. We are distributed by the Public Radio Exchange, better known as PRX. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Mr. Matt Fidler. Our associate producer and owner of a dog named Rocket is Ellie Johnson. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.